Page. As some of you know, I do the radio Bible class every day. And one of the things that the radio Bible class does is to print a little booklet called Our Daily Bread. They put out about 7.5 million every month, and it's used around the world. And in addition to that, they put out a number of Bible study materials, and materials that are designed to speak to crucial issues of our day. Radio Bible class never asks for money. It's just been a policy, and God has supplied for them. And if you were to send in for a tape of our program, they will send you the tape, and they will not put you on the mailing list. But if you'd like to be on the mailing list, to get their Bible study materials and a list of them and our daily bread, and they put this out they put out something every quarter, I think you might find it helpful in your ministry. And if you did feel that, you will find a yellow pad on the table in the back. And if you sign up for it, give us your name and address, I'll send it to them and tell them that you're willing to be put on the mailing list so that you can get the materials that they send out. I think you'll find them helpful. At least there'd be some way in which we could continue to minister to you. And I certainly would be ungracious if I did not say to you how much I've appreciated the hours I have spent on your campus. I've appreciated being with your professors of preaching and with your president, with your dean, and I've appreciated being with many of you. Your affirmations have been encouraging to me, and in the words of Isaiah the prophet, you're a great bunch. But let me come down out of the pulpit and talk to you on more common ground. A while ago, I attended a seminar taught by Tom Peters. He's the guru of business. And Tom Peters began his seminar by saying, I've got bad news for you and I've got good news for you. The bad news is that nobody in business knows what he's doing these days. The good news is that nobody else in business knows what he's doing these days. And then Tom Peters went on to talk about the change. Back in 1983, Peters and Bob Woodward wrote a book called In Pursuit of Excellence. It came as a result of a study of 45 firms in the 70s that were doing business with great skill. And they reported on those businesses and focused in on 12 of them. By 1985, a third of the businesses that they had studied had either gone out of business or had radically changed. By 1987, Peters wrote another book called Managing in Chaos. If you know that book, you know that his basic thesis is that the businesses that would make it through the 90s and into the next millennium are not simply the businesses that are able to adapt to change or anticipate change, but they are the businesses that will thrive in change. Thus his title, Managing in Chaos. Social historians will probably select 1989 as the defining year of this century, just as 1815 was selected as the defining year of the 19th century. 1815, you had the second peace of Paris, and that ushered in 100 years of peace in the continent of Europe. Or just as 1647 and the Peace of Westphalia was the defining year of the 17th century. It was the end of the 30 Years' War and changed the whole complexion of Europe and the Western world. 1989 is selected as the defining year of this century because it's been a century of change. And 1989 was a year of phenomenal change. In fact, in a matter of about 7 months, we had the standoff at Tiananmen Square. There was the crumbling of the Berlin Wall, the beginning of the joining of the two Germanies. The Soviet Union came apart, and communism, which had been the dominant political, economic, and even religious force in the world for 75 years, had suddenly come to nothing. There has probably not been a year in the history of the world in which there has been that much radical change in that short a time without any kind of war. It was chosen as the year that defined our century because it was a year of enormous change. My father was born in 1888, and he died in 1977. In my father's lifetime, he saw overwhelming change. My father's lifetime, the lonely watcher on the hillside was replaced by the scanning of a radar scope. The rider on horseback was replaced by a transcontinental jet. My father saw electric lights installed in New York City. My father saw the invention of the car and the nations of the world ribbon with concrete highways. My dad saw the first, or was alive when the first airplane flight took place. He was around when they had the motion picture theaters. He was around when they came up with the radio and television, first computer. In fact, in 1989, my father sat in front of a television set and watched us as we put men on the moon. In the years that follow, he commented that now there were people circling the Earth, and it didn't even make the front page of the paper. In the years of my father's life, which covered most of the years of this century, my dad saw enormous change. We live in the midst of such change that change for us becomes the norm. We could look at change in all kinds of areas of life. We are aware of it in the area of technology. According to USA Today, when a new computer product is put on the market, either hardware or software, it has a shelf life of 13 months. That is, from the time it first goes on the shelf till the time it's taken off as obsolete, it's just slightly more than a year. If you go to buy one of those products, you're never quite sure when to buy, because if you buy now, what you buy, what you take home, what you get installed is already getting out of date. Change, and we're affected by it. The kind of change that I am concerned about as a communicator is the change that has been taking place in our culture. The changes that have to do with the way we communicate. Let me take just a moment to talk a bit about history of communication. If you go back into antiquity, as far back as we can go, in those early years, people did not communicate by writing, reading. It was an oral culture. That is, everything that was transmitted came from grandfather to father to son to grandson. It was a culture that passed on its laws, its lore, by means of a story, by means of proverb. Later on, somebody began to sketch pictures on the walls of a cave, and the pictures became letters, and the letters became writing. But when writing was invented, they had tablets on which they wrote. And they put on the tablets the law and the lore of the people, but it was only the elite, the scribes of the culture, that were able to write and read. For the great mass of people, there was still just the message transmitted from grandfather to father to son to grandson. It was an oral culture. In the third and second centuries before Christ, there was an explosion of knowledge. In Greece and in Egypt, it's astonishing all that they had learned. One classical scholar said that the Greeks had invented everything the Greeks needed in order to be able to live successfully. And in libraries that had sprung up, libraries like that of Ptolemy Ergetes in Egypt, there was an abundance of knowledge about the world, about the universe. It is staggering how much they knew. And yet, in spite of that, even though there were parchments in those libraries, the average peasant in the field, the workman in the town, could not take out a library card, take out a parchment and read it. It was still a father to son to grandson. It was an oral culture. All of that changed in, 1455 with the invention of the printing press. It's hard for us to imagine how much the printing press changed the whole complex of life. I mean, it was a staggering change. For the first time in history, you had a genuine generation gap. No longer did the son have to ask his daddy or the daddy have to ask the grandfather. Now, if the son was able to read, he could get books, and he had in his library the wisdom of that time. In fact, it was possible in that day for somebody who was well-read to have a library that contained all of the knowledge that people had in the 16th century. It changed the relations between the parents and children. It also changed the education. Up until the time of the printing press, one of the major canons of education was memory. After all, in an oral culture, if you're going to be a scholar and learn it, you have to remember everything you had been told. But within 75 years of the invention of the printing press, that canon, memory, just completely disappeared from education. It also changed the way people comprehended life. When you hear a story, you have to hear it whole and complete. A proverb sums up life in a small, pithy saying. But now, as you would read, you could read line upon line, and what you read had much more of a reasoned argument to it. In fact, if you read this page and you didn't understand it, you could go back a couple of pages before and trace the argument. I mean, things changed just in the way that people began to think. Coming of the printing press changed the religion. If it were not for the printing press, we would not have had the Protestant Reformation. It was because the Bible was put into the hands of the plowman, and because of the theology that was circulated in books, that the Reformation made its impact in Northern Europe and in Great Britain. It is just impossible for us to realize that the single invention of the printing press changed the way people comprehended the world, the way people communicated about the world, the way people thought about themselves and the world. Well, time went on. There were other inventions. 1814, there was the invention of the telegraph. At least that was the time when you could send it on ahead. Interesting, just in passing, the Civil War was the first war, or the war between the states, was the first war that used the telegraph. And it was one of those wars, interestingly enough, where the technology got out ahead of the generals. Most of the generals in the Civil War had been trained at West Point. After they graduated, they chose upside. You be gray, I'll be blue, and they, you know, sort of fought each other. They were all trained with a view of warfare that looked to the past. When they used telegraph, they would send the message, and then they would send a messenger behind it just to be sure it got there. In fact, the technology so outstripped them that they learned to fight in an arena where you used bayonets. I mean, the fighting was up close and personal. But the weapons had advanced so that the guns were far more lethal than they had been in the past. But if you have a battle in which you get close enough to stick a man with a bayonet and then you shoot him, blow up his head or his arm or his leg, we suffered greater casualties on both sides in the Civil War than in all of the other wars America has fought together. The technology had outstripped the general. That's just in passing. Time went on, and in the late 1800s, there was the invention of the radio. And then it touched American life in the 1920s. First religious program came in 1927, KDKA out of Pittsburgh, the broadcast of the first Presbyterian church. The golden age of radio came in 10 years, between 1934 and 1944. Most of you do not know it, but it was a startling time in our country. For the first time, people all over the country were joined together by radio. One of the early programs was Amos and Andy. And when Amos and Andy came on at 7 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock in Chicago, 5 o'clock in the mountains, you know how it goes, traffic would stop. People would literally stop and go into the house to hear Amos and Andy. And people all over the country, for the first time, at the same time, heard the same program. 1934 to 44, you had Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, out of the past of yesteryear into the present, come the roaring hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. Lone Ranger rode again. The time of Jack Benny, the time of Bob Hope, the time of George Burns and Gracie Allen. It was a time of radio preachers like Charles E. Fuller and Walter Meyer, men who commanded a huge audience simply because they were on radio. 10 years, golden age of radio. But in the 1920s, another invention came on the scene. It was television. And the first time television was really put into the public eye was in the New York World's Fair, 1938-39. It was an interesting fair. It was the fair that was looking forward to the future. And most of their predictions were abysmally wrong. They talked about cities that would be alabaster white. They talked about environments that would be clean and pure. They talked about a civilization free of crime. But the one thing they didn't predict was the coming of television. I was a boy when that World's Fair went on, and I remember going to the New York World's Fair. I remember standing in one room in front of a camera, and they told me that the people in the other room could see me. And then I'd go in the other room and see how the camera worked with other people. And they said that there would probably be a time within the next 30 years in which every home in America would have a television set. And as a youngster who had grown up in a fairly strict environment and wasn't even allowed to go to movies, that seemed like a wonderful, wonderful promise. folks in our church did a lot of loony reasoning, but they used to say, you didn't go to movies because if you paid a dime to the movies, you were supporting all the people in the movie industry, and look at what kind of people they were. Well, I figured if you had it in your home, didn't cost you anything, the argument would go, and you could just sit there and watch it all the time. Didn't realize how right I was. In the 1940s, television came into many homes. It was a postage stamp size. But if you had a television set, you were the big person on the block. Folks crowded in to see it. The bars would get television and broadcast the ball games. I was working as a messenger in New York, and I went from bar to bar, from the door of one bar to the door of another bar, watching the ball game. I'd watch a half inning, go on, watch another half inning. By the early 1950s, almost every home had a television set. By the middle of the 1950s, the East Coast and the West Coast were joined together. And by the 1960s, television was just a fact of life. We are the most televised nation on earth. At least according to USA Today, over 80% of American homes have at least two sets. Folks look at television and just assume it as part of life. What I would argue is that television is to the American culture and to the Western world and perhaps to the entire world today every bit as strategic as the invention of the printing press. I think television has done as much to change us and to change our culture, to change the way we comprehend the world, the way we communicate, as the printing press did back in the 16th century. Just look at the kinds of statistics that you have. From the time a child is born until the time she goes off to school, she will have watched 6,000 hours of television. From the time a youngster enters school to the time he graduates, he will have watched another 17,000 hours of television. The average family has the television set on about 40 hours a week. The average person in the family watches television between 23 to 26 hours a week. People watch television more than any other single activity, with the possible exception of sleeping. Television so dominates us that when people are asked what is their major source of news, over 84% say that it is television. In fact, over 55% say that television is their only source of news. If you don't know it, I'll let you in on it. Saddam Hussein is an employee of CNN. Every time they want to raise the ratings, they get him to rattle the sword. It was a strange war. It was a war made for television. You had somebody watching UN forces when the general was saying, we're going to launch our missiles and we're going to put them down the smokestacks down in the capital city of Iraq. And then the guy over in Iraq saying, well, here they come. They just had the explosion. It's like watching a ball game. What was significant was that the brass in the Pentagon watched CNN to find out about the movements of the war. They learned more from CNN than they did from their own sources. Amazing what television has done. Television has not only been there as television, but in addition to that, you have VCRs. Until this year, when personal computers have entered the race, VCRs were the fastest selling appliance that people bought. Most homes that have television have VCRs. All of that says that television has made an impact upon us. It's made an impact upon us not just in the content, it's made an impact upon us in terms of the way we comprehend the world. Just last week, I was in Chicago and had lunch with a publisher, a well-known firm. He said that there was question as to whether that firm could exist for 5 more years because of the price of paper, because of the price of print, and because of the fact that people do not read. That if you get rid of the technical books, doctors reading books on medicine and accountants reading books on accounting, get rid of those books, 90% of all the books published are read by 10% of the people. Most people in our society do not get their information by reading, get their information by looking. Television has made its impact. It is the dominant medium of communication. And I think it has had an effect on the way you and I have to communicate. Totally apart from the content, totally apart from the dancing girls, and totally apart from the semi-pornography that you get. Just the medium itself has made an impact on us. Let me show you some of the ways I think that has made an impact upon preaching, at least the way we communicate to the secular society around us. One of the things that television has done is to turn preaching away from lecture towards conversation. If you listen to preaching of the past, it is much closer to a lecture, closer to what you would get in a university or a seminary classroom than it was what you would get on the street in conversation. Reason for that is that as we have looked at preaching, it has come out of Greco-Roman rhetoric. The Greeks and the Romans put a great emphasis on public address. And many of the early Christians, the leaders, were rhetoricians before they became Christians. Augustine, Chrysostom, Ambrose were all proficient in that field. So it made sense that they would take what they had learned and bring it over to the crafting of Christian sermons. And so much of what we have in homiletics through the centuries goes back to Greco-Roman rhetoric. Greco-Roman rhetoric is always deductive in its structure. As the nature of it is, you state a proposition, and then you either prove it, or you explain it, or you apply it. It's a deductive in its arrangement. Greco-Roman rhetoric usually involves people being able to follow a fairly intricate argument. And it was the dominant motif. It's where we got our 3 points. The 3 points in Greco-Roman rhetoric were pretty good points. First point was, what is it? Second point was, what will it do for me? And the third point is, how do I get it? We now get 3 points, you know, 3 P's in a poem. But back, if you were to take that model, it's not a bad model for speaking. All of that is to say, that was also the way that lectures were developed. Today, because of television, which is a very personal medium, very much one-on-one, preaching moves towards conversation. One of the things about conversation is that it's inductive rather than deductive. It works more with images than it does with the points. Imagine two men get on a plane. They're flying from Charlotte, North Carolina, up to Chicago. One says to the other, "You go to Chicago very often." The other says, "Well, not if I can help it." The other says, "Yeah, I can't stand that place. Can't imagine anyone living there. I mean, either they just had a snowstorm, they're about to have a snowstorm, they're in the middle of a snowstorm, and if it's summertime, it's windy and it's humid. I mean, just a terrible place to live." And the guy said, "Yeah, but you know, great place to make a buck. And I have to go up there, but in these days when business is tough, you go any place you can go to get it. And even if it's a snowstorm, you're glad to make a sale." And the guy says, "Yeah, I have to be up in that area of the country during the winter. And I tell you, I almost freeze to death. But you know, I got some frequent flyer miles. My wife and I are thinking of using and take a trip to Hawaii in another month or so." The guy said, "Well, that's pretty good. You've been to Hawaii before?" "Well, 20 years ago." "Boy, it's changed." "What's different about it?" "Well, Japanese have taken it over. I mean, they own the restaurants. they own everything. In fact, you go in a restaurant, not surprising, you have to read the menu in Japanese. Man, Japanese taking over everything." And the guy said, "You're telling me. I wish the Clinton administration would get on the ball and pull down their tariffs so we can get in there and do some business with them. Instead, they can trade all over the United States. We can't trade there." I said, "Yeah, you know, I'm glad they're having a recession. I mean, they took over a movie house, a whole movie industry here. Next thing you're going to find, that all the film's going to be in Japanese. We have to read English subtitles or Japanese subtitles." Oh, you know, just. And they also bought the Rockefeller Center in New York. You got to pay in yen to get in there. And the guy says, "You know, we're really in a mess in business because of that. In fact, I hope that the Republicans really wise up with this GATT treaty. I mean, we're letting all these people come in and shipping our goods out there for them to work at it. They get 15 cents an hour and our guys get $15 an hour. How do you compete with that?" And so the conversation goes. If you analyze that conversation, it is not deductive. They did not say when they got in. Now, I've got three major points I'd like to cover about this matter of business in the United States. Business is bad. That's why we'll go to Chicago. The Japanese and others are competing with us. And the GATT treaty has hurt business. Not the way conversations go. Conversations move from one movement to another. They flow. Very seldom in a conversation do you point out the points. The conversation by its very nature is inductive rather than deductive. Seldom in a conversation do people state their point and then go on to talk about it. They usually just sort of talk about it and then the point seems to emerge. That's the way conversation works. That's the way preaching tends to move, towards induction rather than deduction. You'll discover today that the Greco-Roman model, which served us well for centuries, does not serve us well today. And part of the reason for that is that what you get on television is always like a conversation. Whenever you get somebody making a formal speech on television, the ratings always go down. C-SPAN, a very interesting and helpful channel, gets virtually no audience to speak of, because they have a lot of people just talking and doing the kind of thing they do in classrooms. And the American public just doesn't tune in. So one of the things that it has done is moved us toward conversation, away from lecture. It has moved us towards conversation also in the way we deliver the message. We talked about this briefly yesterday, but today in the secular culture, people who are attracted to the ministry are not attracted to people who speak as authorities. But one of the things that characterizes this society of ours is that they no longer give to you as a preacher the authority you deserve. you really speak as one without authority. As a result, people respond to conversational tone, rather than to somebody who speaks as an authority who has spent a night on the mountain and has gotten the message and he has come down. Somebody who talks to them as you might talk one-on-one, not the conversation of the cafeteria, but the same variety of rate and pitch and force. So the people sense, well, he's talking with me rather than at me. Just a matter of accurate reporting that has changed. Not only has television changed from declamation to conversation, but television's made another change, and that is it has gotten us to focus on story and image. We are back now to what is an oral culture. The way values are communicated, the way ideas are communicated, is by the use of story. In television, they tell you the big story in order to tell you the little story. Big story is the mystery, the police drama, the Western, the comedy. Little story is the commercial. Look at how many commercials are framed like a story. A woman discovers that the company is coming. And she has taken her dishware, her glasses, out of the washer, and she discovers that there is spots on the glasses. And she knows this is the end of her social life. People are going to come and criticize her. She's going to be, you know, destroyed. But fortunately, she has a next-door neighbor who always carries an extra box of suds around with her, and they put the stuff in the washer, and they come out, and all the spots are gone, and her, you know, social life is saved. You know, drama and 60 seconds, but it moves the merchandise. My son-in-law is a sportscaster, does the Texas Ranger games, he does games for ESPN. One of the things he says is that before you get on the air, you have to decide what the storyline of the game is. I mean, you don't simply say that the Pittsburgh Steelers are playing the Dallas Cowboys for the Super Bowl. May the best team win. Oh, no, you have to talk about the Cowboys, and you have to talk about Jerry Jones, the owner, and the kind of problem he has been to the league, and you have to talk about Switzer and his being a college coach trying to make it in the pros, but you have to talk about the Dallas Cowboys that threaten to be a dynasty, and you have to talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers. These are working class men, you know, these are tough, rough guys. And they're going to come in against this sophisticated Dallas Cowboy team that's a 17-point favorite. The question is, can David once again rise against Goliath? Can, depending on your side, good triumph over evil? But they know that unless they put that into a story form, they lose the power of that game. If you watch Monday Night Football, the first 3 minutes, when they come on, designed to set up the story. Even if they got two last place teams, they find something that puts drama into it. They tell stories. Communicators today have to be able to put what they're saying into narrative form. I am not talking about preaching skyscraper sermons, one story after another with very little in between. What I am saying is that it's imperative that as we take the truth of God, we move it towards experience and life. If you listen to conversation, listen to the way people communicate. They don't sit, they don't gossip about ideas. Gossip about people, about things, about events. And you ought to be a student of communication. You ought to be a student of conversation. Listen to the way people here talk to one another. Listen to how we communicate. Listen to how often we just get down into the gutty business of living and try to explain ourselves and our ideas. You come into the pulpit and you're in a culture now that is a storied culture. The good communicators understand the need for narrative. You don't get a lot of that at a seminary. Nature of getting an education is that you learn to become more and more abstract. That's a good thing. But the danger of it is that you come into the seminary talking about murder, rape, and robbery, and then you leave the seminary talking about hematology. Come into the seminary talking about, when Jesus is going to come back, and you leave talking about eschatology. Now, I'm not putting that down. Don't misunderstand me. Educated people need to have a shorthand in which to think and converse. But when you go out into the into the churches, they'll still talk about murder, rape, and robbery, and incest, and wife abuse. Good preaching moves towards where the people are. To get an education, you go up the abstraction ladder. To communicate, you have to come down that abstraction ladder. You keep your preaching close to life. We don't really think stories can carry the message. When I was going to seminary, they told me a lot of stuff. Some of it was true, some of it was false. Had 30 years to, ferret it out. One thing they said is you can never base doctrine on a parable. It was that, it's sheer nonsense, because Jesus communicated with parables, told 38 of them. But if you say, well, who are the theologians in the New Testament? Well, Paul was, he was a theologian. And I think John was a theologian. Yeah, maybe James. Nobody ever mentions Jesus. It's interesting, in the Apostles' Creed, Jesus' teaching ministry is dismissed with a semicolon. He was born of the Virgin Mary, semicolon, suffered under Pontius Pilate. Nothing about his teaching ministry. In fact, I've often wondered, suffered under Pontius Pilate. I wonder if Pilate someplace is saying, how in the world did I get in that creed? But we don't believe stories can carry it. If I say to you, look, last month I read 3 novels. You say, what, you take your vacation in January? Because we associate the reading of a novel with entertainment. But I think you could argue that novels have done as much to change the way people think and act and feel as any abstract tome on theology has. Okay. Television has moved us in that direction. It also, like it or not, has made it more difficult for younger people to follow a defined, precise argument. The best listened to channel of people between 12 and 24 is MTV. More people, that age group, watch that channel than any other. You get folks over 40, they just flip right past it. Sometimes you gotta stop, watch it. Not only for its message, and some of its message is a kind of thing we could speak to, but notice how quickly they flash the images. The president of MTV was asked a while ago if he thought he influenced the youth of America, and he said, we don't influence them, we own them. They come to listen to you. They are not capable of following a sustained argument. Get people over 50, 55, they do it pretty well. That's how they grew up. That's the kind of education they got. I don't like the world this way. On a Tuesday, I wasn't looking and they changed it and nobody asked me. But I have to communicate to that world that I'm given. I have to play the cards that I'm dealt. That's how people learn. Emphasis on story. One last thing. And that is, I think that television has put a tremendous emphasis on the introduction to a sermon. Television has made it such that you can't take time to get underway, to get started, to begin. On our cable system up in Gloucester, Massachusetts, we have an old movie channel. Since I wasn't allowed to watch them when I was a kid, I'm catching up on the things I had lost. But you ever watch some of those old movies? It starts out giving you the title of the movie. And then it tells you who the major players are. Then it tells you the supporting cast. And then it tells you who did the photography. And then it tells you who did the wardrobe. And then it tells you who did the producing. And then it tells you who did the directing. And then it starts the program. It starts the movie, the story. Flip over 3 channels and pick up a modern story. And what happens? It starts with the action. fact, it not only starts with the action, they begin to flash the title over the action. They don't stop and say, this is who the person is doing this. They show you immediately what's going on. They hook you. Movies start that way because most movies are sold with an eye to the VCR market. And so they immediately get underway. They begin. And they know that unless you have chosen to watch that program, Fraser or Roseanne, you've chosen it, that they have between 15 and 30 seconds to hook you or you'll go on with your clicker. And men go on with the clicker. It's a man thing. You know, if they don't get you in 15 to 30 seconds, they can't keep you, and they know that. When people come to hear you preach, they come with clickers in their heads. You think they change just because they came to church? Don't kid yourself. They make, and there's a lot of evidence for this, they make up their mind in the first 30 seconds, whether if they haven't known you before, whether they'll like you or not like you. They'll make up their mind in the first 30 seconds whether this is going to be interesting or uninteresting. They'll make up their minds in the first minute whether this has anything to do with them or not. They make up their minds within that first minute as to whether they're going to tune out and go in their heads to some other kind of land and just let you talk. Are they going to tune in? If you don't tell them in the first minute, at least work to get their interest, give them some idea that this is going to be important to them, they're gone. In a day gone by, you could start by saying, you know, today we're in the book of Galatians, and we're in Galatians chapter 3. Last week we're in Galatians chapter 2. If you can count, next week we'll be in Galatians chapter 4. Now, let me tell you about the problem of legalism that they had in Galatia. Those folks sit there, Galatia sounds like a dessert. The truth is, they don't care about legalism in Galatia. They don't care about David. They don't care that Abraham went down into Egypt, and that was a terrible thing for Abraham to do. I'd never do that. There's probably not a person in your congregation tempted to go to Egypt. And you look at the titles you get in the newspapers. Man's going to talk on the life of Abraham, or Abraham and Haran. I mean, title. Can you imagine a man getting up 8 o'clock Sunday morning and say, "Honey, get out of bed, get out of bed. I'm going to talk about Abraham and Haran. I want to get a good seat for that." I mean, they're lucky to make it to church, and you've got 60 seconds to go after them. Introductions have taken on an importance today that they did not have in the past. And good preachers know that. They go for the jugular. I was talking to a publisher in New York about 6 months ago. He said there's a formula for good writing. In the first paragraph or two, you go after the jugular vein. In the second paragraph or two, you begin to squeeze the vein. The third, fourth paragraph, you slam that reader up against the wall, and then you hold her there breathless till the end of the book. He said, when they don't fit that formula, we seldom publish them. Preaching may not be that dramatic, but it's got to go after the jugular fast. And television has done that. Like it or not, it has influenced the way people listen. It has moved preaching from lecture towards conversation. It has put an emphasis on the visual, on the narrative, on the story. And it's put an emphasis on the way that sermons are formed. It gets us off to a good start if we're going to get into the sermon at all. This is a challenging age. But every person in our age has a right to hear the gospel and to hear the scriptures preached in ways. And we cannot ask that audience to adapt to us, as communicators, without sacrificing the message. We must adapt to them. so that they will hear it in a way they understand. Let me pray for you. Father, I pray for these women and men who are here today. As they move out to share your truth with those in our society who are without God and without hope. We pray, Lord, that you'd keep us from boring people with the message. Keep us from being so interested in the audience that we sacrifice the message. Or so interested in the message that we ignore the audience. Use these men and women. Use them mightily. Use them where they serve now, where they will serve in the years to come. I want to thank you for them. And thank you for this school, for its faculty, for its leadership. In Jesus' name.